You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and you are very welcome to Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a program of author interviews and book reviews from around the sound and beyond, and I'm your host, Chris Wilson. Today, we're going to be talking to award-winning New York Times best-selling author and special DJ of Johnny's Garage, Jonathan Evason, on KPTZ. And he's also the author of 7 great novels. I talked to him, several years ago, about his book West of Here that was set on the Olympic Peninsula. And since then, he's had great success with Revised Fundamentals of Caregiving. You can stream the movie on Netflix. And now he's written a great epic of America called Small World. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me, Chris. I've been really enjoying your show. You know, I'm a KPTZ listener well as a contributor. So, you know, I'm always driving around my car, running my errands, and I got to hear you, Jess Walter, with the Unbook Lover, and I'm like, this is great. And then coincidentally, you reached out to me like several days after that aired again.
Well,
so thanks for having me.
You know, both you and Jess write these kinds of historical novels, and this book is an historical novel, and, you know, that's right up my alley. I love these books that have, you know, lots of characters and span time. So this is such a book, and actually the Washington Post said, Small World feels like a big statement about America. So that's a great review. Can you kind of set the stage for us? Tell us a little bit about this book so people understand.
To be quite honest, it was shortly before my 50th birthday, and I had come off a string of novels that I'm not going to call them quiet by any stretch. I mean, they had their share of literary derring do and formal challenges, but they were smaller books, more character studies, and not since West of Here, back in 2010, had I really tried to write a world beater. And so I was about to turn 50, and I'm like, I don't know. This one was born of the conceit of it. It was like, man, I want to take a swing at the great American novel. And then, so first thing I had to do is kind of define what that was, because it's such a that term encompasses so many books and such a divergent group of books, anything from Catcher in the Rye to Invisible Man to, you know, The Adventures of Augie March. Kind of the book that came closest to my conception of what the great American novel was actually 3 books. John Dos Passos' USA trilogy, which covered, you know, 2 or 3 decades of American history in a similar way that I work with Small World, using numerous limited points of view to sort of create a larger cultural puzzle. And so I decided I wanted to tell America's story through the biggest, most diverse cast I possibly could, you know, because you can't really talk about the American experiment without putting pluralism front and center. So I wanted to write a novel, kind of a salve for our national identity right now, because we're hurting, and for good reason, you know. We're kind of at a low point in our history, and I wanted to write a book that was kind of a salve to that. One that would take an unsentimental look at you know, our failed institutions, you know, slavery, manifest destiny, an unflinching look at all that's wrong with America, but at the same time, a celebration of this blended palette of stories, which was, you know, originally supposed to be our strength and has now devolved into this sort of tribalism. So, sorry, long explanation, right?
No, but very to the point.
Basically, it's about 20 characters spread out over 170 years of American history. And there's a bifurcated timeline. Half of it takes place in 1850s, and half of it takes place in modern times. It's all sort of pulled together by the railroad, because we follow the construction of the Transcontinental Railroad in the 19th century, and then the scions of these people from 5 generations earlier are all find themselves on the same doomed passenger train. Amtrak train.
We're not giving anything away, because you tell us that in the first chapter.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. That's on the first page. So, I hope that gives you an idea. I mean, it's a big novel of blended stories, but they all sort of converge. The novel is built to be kind of like a puzzle. I think the reader is kind of reading along at first, and they're feeling like, okay, these are really cool 19th century vignettes. But then you start to see how everything is connected, and then there's this whole other timeline that comes in. And the reader just gets sort of a broader and large, this big puzzle that we call America.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love the characters. I love the people that you're writing about. And you start with the Bergens and they're Irish. Is that how you started thinking about this book? Is that your point of entry? Was it place? Was it an event? Was it these characters?
It was. I kind of came up with all the characters in pretty much one night when I conceived it. I can't remember exactly who came first, okay. Whether it was the Bergens or whether it was the flowers. What I knew was that I really wanted this to be a dynamic cast and a representative cast, and so that meant you know, so much of the American mythos is about these European immigrants coming into Ellis Island. Of course, this is before Ellis Island even. Mm-hmm. More importantly, or equally important, if not more importantly, are the people that were here before us and the people who were brought here against our will. So I wanted to cover characters that were, you know, outside of my personal purview, you know, the purview of my personal experience. But I couldn't write a novel about diversity without writing outside of my purview of experience, and it's all historical fiction anyway.
Yeah,
so I came up with all these characters, and then it just became kind of a call and response between these genealogical lines and these characters that end up crossing paths throughout their histories. It all sort of, you know, melds into one, like I said, one big blended palette of American lives. Mm-hmm. But I think all the characters kind of came the first night I conceived of it.
Well,
not every character, but the main eight characters or ten characters.
Yeah, right. So there's the Bergens, the Irish, and the Flowers, African American, Chens, Chinese, and the Tullys, Native American. You wouldn't think Tully would be the Native American name, but wow. I mean,
a Christian adopted name.
Right. So there's heroes and there's villains, there's love stories, there's, you know, daring do and great adventure. And it's kind of immigrant stories that's an important issue of our time, yet you don't beat our heads over with this. I just want to compliment you on that. That you're writing about important things that we are thinking about, but not in a pedantic way, telling us how we should.
Right.
Think.
The last thing I want to do is write a political polemic. I feel like it's my job to start cultural conversations, you know, and stimulate larger discussions, but not necessarily to edify anybody or voice my worldview upon them. You know, well, maybe subtly, I'd like to do that, but
mm-hmm. Right. Well, you know, these people, so many things, you know, happen to them. How do you weave this plot? How do you decide what's going to happen next?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, it always begins with characters for me. And the character arc to me is like, you know, that is what we call drama. I mean, you know, you have a character starting at point A, which is just, you know, that's the character's reality, and then you're trying to get them over there to point Z, which is their idealized reality, what they want to be. And so usually I just follow a character arc because it's just the sort of, it's how we, this Aristotelian arc, this rising action, rising stakes, this is how we, you know, as Westerners metabolize stories and have mm-hmm. for a long time. It's fun for me to find ways to try to frustrate that. And one of the ways is to tell many stories at once, because what happens is this had to become more of an orchestral piece where something like Revised Fundamentals of Caregiving or Lawn Boy has that traditional sort of character arc, but it's only one character and it's first person and it talks to you like a friend. So it's pretty easy to track that way. This way, I can't have 20 different character arcs all sort of running on the same schedule. You know what I mean?
Right.
Or the novel would be uneven. So it became more of an orchestral piece where the thing itself, the novel, the larger picture had to become sort of, the arc had to be built into there. So, you know, something good may be happening to one character, but then something bad is happening to another. You know, mm-hmm. you have to reverse these emotional charges to give the reader a good ride. But when you have 20 stories, you have to find a way to do that more like an orchestral piece, mm-hmm. Where they complement each other, where they play off each other, where there has to be a connectivity. I had to design one of the big problems I ran into is when you have all these characters, it just means that most of your characters are going to be off the page for 60 and 70 pages at a time. And I didn't want to write a novel that had one of those persona dramatists at the beginning, or a key, where, because then you lose the reader, you know?
Right, you're thinking about your reader.
When you're reading a book and you're like, who is this again? I got to go back and look at the beginning, at the family tree. I needed the characters to be fluid and easily trackable for the reader so that they could put together this puzzle in a sort of an organic way. And so I kind of developed this system of connectivity, ways to remind the reader at all time of all these other characters when they were off the page, which is most of the book, you know? And so genealogy obviously was a big one because these people are related. And place was another one. Theme was another one. Happenstance was another one. I mean, there was 5, 6, 7 levels deep of like little ways, subtle ways of connecting the story in the reader's mind without even having to mention characters' names, you know? I mean, I think that was kind of the key to pulling off the novel, was without people getting lost.
Right.
I think a lot more people got lost with West of Here. West of Here was a very similar book in certain ways, they're companions, but West of Here took a different tact at that, and I think it was harder for people to make those connections. So in a way, I think I got better at that.
Yes, I agree. And there were connections. You were thinking about, oh, you know, are they going to go to the same farm, you know, downstate Illinois? Oh, no, you know, that type of thing. There were connections, and there were some, you know, really horrible things that happened to your characters, but there was also a lot of hope. There were these angels. There were these compassionate people. So tell us about a little bit about that, how that balanced.
Yeah, I believe in people. I still do. I mean, let's be honest, the last 6, 7 years, my faith in humanity's taken a little bit of a hit, but you know, I remember, I think in the New York Times when they reviewed the book, it was a rave review. The woman loved it, but she said, do I believe that there's all these good people? Not really. You know, but I loved reading it. You know what I mean? I'm not that way. I'm optimistic. I know there's good people out there, and I know tough situations bring out the best in them. I think we just live in an era now where the level of our political dialogue has just evolved to the point where it's just like it's like, who's afraid of Virginia Woolf or something, you know? I mean, it's just too... an old married couple just saying stuff they don't even mean at each other just to win the argument kind of thing. But I still do believe in people. And I mean, I've had the benefit of angels in my time and, you know, I don't want to write books that aren't hopeful.
This is definitely hopeful.
I love Cormac McCarthy. Don't get me wrong. I love him, but I don't want to write a Cormac McCarthy book where, you know, people are eating babies all the time and stuff. That's just not my style. I mean, I want to give people a little hope without being, you know, a lot of people find my books depressing, which I find ironic because I mean for them to be hopeful, realistic, but hopeful. But
okay, I do not find them depressing. You know, these are stories about wealth, too, and finding opportunity. That seems to be a recurrent theme for your families.
Yeah, for my books, too. You're absolutely right. Like a book like Lawn Boy, totally different on the surface. It's a first-person buildings roman, kind of a funny novel that's a picaresque. But really, it's a companion novel to this, which is formally so different. Big, sweeping, third-person limited, historical. But they both are asking the same fundamental questions about the American dream and why is it harder for some people than others to achieve the American dream? What good is this ideal if it's a lie? Is America really making good on any of these promises? How can we improve ourselves? You know, what can we celebrate about American culture? These are all the same questions in both of those books, but the two books couldn't be more different.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Well, it's certainly easier for some people to climb the ladder than it is for others. But, you know, there is the belief that, you know, if you work hard enough and you're in the right place at the right time, that it will come to you. So this is a story about that, you know, some people easily find opportunity and some people don't. And
sometimes those that easily find it, it's not as easy as, you know, there are so many repercussions, like, you know, without going into Wu Chen's character, yes, he sort of lucks into opportunity, but at what cost, you know?
That's an incredible story. There's so many people and incidents to delve into here. And like the connections, how did you just, as you were writing, just think about, how to connect one family to another? Or did you have to go back and work on that?
A little bit of both. But really, I mean, since it was designed, it was conceived as a novel about these connections. So I kind of mapped things out. And when I say map them out, I don't necessarily mean an outline. I have everybody's sort of arc. I know what needs to happen for them to get them to where I want them to be at the end. So it's not a matter of having all the set pieces worked out or all the occasions when the characters converge worked out in advance. But you are always thinking about those opportunities as you build. And so I wrote the book organically. I mean, it's written exactly. People ask me, well, did you write each storyline and then separately, which would make sense. I mean, mm-hmm. But for me, I felt like I'd be missing too many opportunities if I just wrote the story separately. So I wrote it just as it appears, pretty much. I mean, mm-hmm. I shuffled a couple chapters here and there, but I needed it to unfold organically so that I could foresee these opportunities for connection.
Right.
In every way, thematically, character-wise, story-wise, in every way. So when I work that way, and then at the end of the, two, three drafts, then you can also find, you can go back and look for missed opportunities, for like, there's a couple talismans in the novel. There's one in particular, without spoiling it, that I didn't conceive until like a later draft of the book, and yet it weaves its way through the entire book. Because once you finished it, once you know what you're trying to accomplish with the book and you're pretty close to accomplishing it, that's when the fun begins. That's when you can really take things to the next level and start reverse engineering these connections in there that are really, I think, pretty thrilling for the reader or whatever.
Wait, Jonathan,
revelatory moments.
We're having so much fun. I have to tell our listeners, stop for a minute and say, you're listening to Jonathan Evason on Book Lovers Cafe. And we're talking about his most recent and highly acclaimed book, Small World, an American novel, a sweeping American novel. And if you missed part of this or want to go back and listen to it again, go to kptz.org and click on the podcast page. And there you'll find this Book Lovers Cafe and others to listen to, like the Jess Walters interview about Cold Millions. So, Jonathan, here we are. And I have to say that I was really hooked when I was reading the steerage scene, the scene about coming across from Ireland. And there's been many books that have talked about immigrants, but this was seems so authentic. And then once they're in the Lower East Side, the mud and the smells and everything, how did you get that authenticity?
Just by getting out of my own way. I mean, that's the best answer I can give you. I mean, obviously tons of, research and finding out whatever I can about a subject and talking to people who know a lot about it. I've done a lot of 19th century reading. I, for instance, just reading Dickens helped a lot. Mm. Just the way I approached I couldn't help but think of Dickens describing the East End of London when I was describing Five Points in New York at roughly the same point in history, the mm-hmm. mid-19th century.
And that's true.
So, I mean, I grew up on Dickens, mm-hmm. So I got a real... I have this sort of Victorian voice in me. I don't always use it. I've only used it twice in this book and in West of Here, but it's in me and it comes out naturally just because Dickens was it for me,
Right.
I don't know. The authenticity is just, it's the life of the imagination,
And then there's the basketball scene.
I've gotten better at researching.
Yeah.
It doesn't help to read huge books, tons of books I found out. You just get lost. It starts to get in the way of the story you're trying to tell. It's more on a scene-to-scene basis, just knowing what's authentic, knowing mm-hmm. what's credible, what's not. You can't, like I see a movie like Gangs of New York, and it's just, which also takes place in Five Points, the neighborhood we're talking about here. And it's just so full of anachronisms and historical, misinformation. It drives me crazy. I know that I can't hit any false notes with this stuff. I've got to make it as authentic and true because I'm always thinking about the reader. And I know when I read something and it doesn't feel authentic, well, then the writer loses me.
I want to talk also, before we run out of time, about the basketball scene. Now, I am not a basketball fan, but I found this description riveting. I just was totally there on the courts with Malik. So, are you a big basketball fan? How did you
write
this? I am.
I love hearing that, though, that you didn't like, because, you know, the reason I love all sports, but basketball is one I think I've written about basketball in two or three novels. To different degrees, but it's just such a beautiful thing. I like to write action, period, you know, and writing the action of, like, now I'm writing about boxing too a little bit, and it's such a beautiful thing to write about. It's really heartening to hear when a reader connects with that. You know, I wrote about bodybuilding and all about Lulu, and it's like, who wants to read about bodybuilding? But, you know, when you immerse somebody in that world and you can bring it to life, and it's really interesting. It's just like writing any other kind of action. So mm-hmm. I'm glad that I know basketball fans would like that part, but I've heard from a number of people that don't really like basketball that were like, yeah, I was riveted during the basketball scenes, which is great. I love hearing that.
Right. It is. So I know that you work a lot. And so can you tell us a little bit about your next book or books, or what's coming along for you next?
Okay, well, I finished a Western, and we'll just kind of call it a Western.
Okay, called, set in the West.
Last of the Californios, but I'm not going to publish it next.
Uh-huh.
It kind of came out of the small world fictive universe a little bit, and it's a little too close, and I like to change things up. So I'm writing this book called Again and Again, which is ostensibly a narrative about past lives. So it takes place from the 9th century, you know, Spain under the Moors.
Oh, you got me there.
Yeah, it flips around in history too, but it has a sort of a different narrative mechanism. It doesn't do it in the same way as Small World, but I think it's equally challenging and broad. Like I've got a lot of different stories to juggle here, and so I have to figure out, again, like a sort of a orchestral way to deal with it. But it's going to be a different sounding orchestra than Small World.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be a little crazier.
Okay. So that's the book you're working on now, Again and Again. And it's about past lives. Is that what?
Yeah. I can't go too far into it because I will spoil it.
No. Okay. So I just wanted to make sure I heard you correctly. And then there's a book based on some character that was in or not in Small World.
Yeah,
well,
I started with Alejo Guzman, who is a character who was cut out of Small World.
Oh, okay.
I had a line of Mexican characters, too, and the reason they got cut from Small World was because, not they were some of my favorite characters in the novel, I was just having trouble. It was just nuts and bolts story stuff. It was just too mm-hmm. hard to get them to converge, to get them on the train, given their locations, it was just a bunch of practical considerations made the novel not run smoothly.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, you know, a 6-cylinder engine and one of the cylinders wasn't.
But you didn't want to give up on the Guzmans.
No, and that's one of the first times that's happened to me. I mean, I've killed lots of characters over the time, but I love this character, Alejo. And his story was just a little different from the beginning because it was a little more classically a Western, because it's kind of a subverted Western. But I started there, and that's why I didn't want to publish it next to, just because part of it takes place around Shasta City and the same place. And I don't want to get into that rhythm where it's like, I mean, that's kind of, it's not a sequel, but you know what I mean? I like to keep the reader guessing a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, I look forward to reading both of those books in the future. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having you. Thanks for having the show. I love it. It's always such a treat when I'm driving around doing my errands and I hear people talking about books.
Yes.
It doesn't happen often enough in our culture.
Well, maybe I'll do more of them. I don't know. Anyway, we're talking to Jonathan Evason, and we're talking about Small World. And he's also the author of West of Here that was set in, I have to say, the Olympic Peninsula and Port Angeles, and also the revised fundamentals of caregiving and Lawn Boy and Harriet, the Harriet book. Tell me the whole title of the Harriet book.
This Is Your Life, Harriet Chance.
This Is Your Life, Harriet Chance. So there's a lot to discover here. And thanks again, Jonathan. Please, everyone, join me next time to talk more about books and authors. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. And once again, you can listen to past shows on the podcast page on the website, KPTZ. You can make a donation to the station there as well. Thanks to the engineer today, Taylor Clark, and our editor, Carl Allen, and all the volunteers and supporters who make this wonderful radio station possible. We'll see you next time. There's always another book to read. Okay, we're done.
Hey, thanks, Chris. Thanks, Taylor. That was a pleasure. I appreciate it. Half hour is perfect.
Isn't it? I think so.
Our closing music for Book Lovers Cafe today is by Bucca White, The Black Crane Blues, from 1940.
My heart is filled with pain. I believe I can't be trained. My heart is filled with pain. I believe I can't be trained. The one I love, she has another man. Young company train, and I ain't got no chain. Young company train, and I ain't got no chain. All I can do, just stand and wring my hand. I don't feel shame, standing and wringing my hand at the train. I don't feel shame, standing and wringing my hand at the train. I ain't the first man the train left cold and hang. Now the same big black train that put me in a strain. That the same big black train that put me in a strain. I ride the train, keep the women from spinning my chain. I don't see nothing but hands standing at the train. I don't see nothing but hands standing at the train. That the same black train that left me in a strain.